Hi there, this is Marion. Welcome to this DebtWire Europe podcast. I'm a restructuring reporter, and I've been rather preoccupied as of late. As many of you will be aware, one of the UK's largest construction companies recently folded in the cards on its gamble to survive. That's right, we're here to talk about Carillion, its liquidation, and what that means for the UK's rescue culture. And by we, let me introduce you. Sitting here with me today is restructuring guru Andrew Wilkinson. He's a partner in Weil Gotshal Manges' European restructuring team. Over the last 30 years, both as a lawyer and a banker at Goldman, he's worked for corporates, creditors, and governments on all sides of the issues. Some of the flagship situations he's worked on include Northern Rock, Stemcor, Eurotunnel, some of the large energy restructurings of this cycle, and of course, Ukraine. The list can go on. And lately, he's been rather vocal about the failure of a restructuring case that is Carillion. So today, along with my colleague Don Grocock, a legal analyst with DebtWire Europe and a former practicing restructuring lawyer, we hope to delve into some of the ramifications the Carillion case has on the restructuring regime in the UK. So it was shocking to see a business of Carillion's size and complexity go straight into liquidation, rather than making use of some of the existing restructuring frameworks in the UK or elsewhere. Then that's been followed in recent weeks by Toys R Us UK and Maplin both going into administration. So Andrew, does Carillion's sudden filing for compulsory liquidation and some of the failures we're seeing in Toys R Us and Maplin cases, do those expose key weaknesses in the UK insolvency and pre-insolvency regime? What are those weaknesses?
And when I first started studying insolvency law, the Insolvency Act was a thin thing. And then over the years, it's become, the body of legislation has become simply massive. And each year it arrives on my desk at Weil, volumes of the insolvency legislation, insolvency rules, and it has become incredibly complicated and incredibly detailed. But behind it, I think there are some simple propositions that we can kind of analyse as we look at what is right and potentially what is wrong with insolvency law. And I should say that I'm focusing here particularly on the law as it relates to the restructuring of large corporate enterprises, where I've spent most of my career. So I think the sort of first point is a very obvious point, is that simply because a company fails, it does not mean there's something wrong with the insolvency legislation. From time to time, enterprises fail. And as I was thinking about what I was going to say this morning, I did check a quote I'm very fond of saying to my students, that insolvency or bankruptcy is the handmaiden of capitalism. And I just thought I'd better attribute that quote to somebody. So I Googled it this morning, and if that turns out that there isn't a quote that's attributable to anybody. But I will accept ownership of the quote. But I do think that as part of capitalism, you have failure of companies. I mean, it is as either lenders or shareholders take risk. From time to time, the risks will go wrong and enterprises will fail. And that is not a bad thing. That can be a good thing. The critical thing is how they fail. And I'm very conscious that if we look at the recent failures, Maplin, Toys R Us, two enterprises that went into administration, and then Carillion, there's a great danger of looking across all of those things and generalising. And I think the focus should be, how they failed and the circumstances of the end of their lives as going concerns. And what was striking about Carillion was first of all the suddenness of the collapse. Secondly, that serious attempts to restructure the enterprise were not undertaken. And thirdly, that the government through the insolvency service has ended up as the liquidator. And whilst I entirely accept that the government insolvency service does a splendid and thorough job, I don't think anybody expected that in looking at the insolvency legislation that an enterprise the size of Carillion, with its 43,000 employees and many dependent sort of customers and suppliers, a big listed public company, would fail so spectacularly and so quickly, and find that it is the government ultimately that is responsible as the liquidator for deciding what happens during the insolvency. And I think that is such an unusual instance that it does, it should give rise to the question, is there something wrong with the insolvency legislation? And so before I pause, I think it's also worth remembering that the Insolvency Act has been in place for 30 years. I am, I'm afraid, old enough to remember sitting at my desk at what was then Clifford Chance, and I was given the job of working out what the Insolvency Act 1985 was designed to do, and we wrote a memo on it. And what it was designed to do was enable enterprises to be restructured. And over the sort of following 30 years, that's not really what's happened with the insolvency legislation. I'm also, I think it's also worth noting that at the time of the financial crisis in 2008, it became absolutely apparent to everybody, including the then governor of the Bank of England, that the legislation for restructuring or rescuing banks, financial institutions, did not work. And following that, there was a complete overhaul of the law relating to the restructuring of financial institutions. That has not happened to corporates. And the reason either is that the corporate restructuring regime works just fine and doesn't need changing, or in fact, there is something wrong with it, and maybe some things that are sort of similar to the defects in the law relating to bank restructuring, but nobody's got around to addressing the elements of the corporate restructuring regime that don't work and try to change them. So I think 30 years in, 10 years after the financial crisis and post-Carillion, the time has come for a sort of hard look at what works in insolvency legislation and potentially what doesn't work.
Thank you, Andrew. So you've alluded to the fact that it's a whole 30 years that the Insolvency Act has been in force, and also touched on the banking special administration regime that we've seen put in place post-Lehman. The UK Insolvency Service is already considering its options for reform of the UK's corporate insolvency regime, including the introduction of a moratorium, creation of a new restructuring plan, and also options for rescue financing. Do you think that any of these reforms could have helped Carillion to restructure rather than fall into liquidation? And which elements of the government's proposal do you find particularly interesting?
Yeah, that's right. So over the last sort of decade, there has from time to time been attention given to insolvency law reform. And I remember, I think it was 2006, sort of Peter Mandelson came back from a trip to the United States and said the UK should look at Chapter 11. And that, I think, briefly made its way into the Conservative Party manifesto and featured in the in a CBI conference in 2006 or 2007, but was all overtaken by the financial crisis. And I think the pre-financial, global financial crisis attempts to consider Chapter 11 was simply subsumed in the focus on bank restructuring, and there was not the government bandwidth to address corporate restructuring reform. So since then, you're right. There is a consultation paper, and one of the things with insolvency law reform is it's a little bit like the sort of First World War generals planning for the last war, not the war they're actually in. And as capital structures become more complicated, and as enterprises evolve, the things that consultation, that law reform, you know, focuses on, sometimes gets overtaken by events. So, taking the sort of the government's most recent consultation, a stay. Yes, I'm a fan of a stay. We do find that that in instances where we're attempting to restructure a complex enterprise, that some creditors may look to take action against the company, and the whole process of negotiating waivers and standstills and forbearances is a time-consuming and expensive process. Expensive because it generally requires fees to be paid. And if that could be replaced by a statutory stay, I think that would be a helpful thing. I don't think, incidentally, that would have saved on its own Carillion, no. But it's a helpful thing. Then the second thing is financing. Over the years, there's been a lot of attention to how do you put in place financing to bridge through to a restructuring. And I think the honest answer to that issue is that where it is clear that a company has a future and there is it is likely that a restructuring plan will be put in place, a way is normally found to provide bridge financing.
Yeah.
And in many deals that we have worked on, it's been complicated and difficult, but generally financing gets put in place. Mm-hmm. So I'm one of those people that thinks that introducing some sort of dip lending, you know, regime into the UK is not critical, and I don't think it's the biggest problem we've got with the restructuring regime at the moment. But I think what Carillion puts a spotlight on is a problem that has been around with administration from the beginning, and that's something that is just central to the English law approach to insolvency, and that is contract termination. So England is one of those jurisdictions that gives great respect to what is written down onto the page, and the way that the UK approaches. Contracts written to terminate on an insolvency event of default is to give effect to those clauses, and that's the so-called ipso facto issue. And that has been built into the English approach to restructuring for a very long time. Now, if you take that and apply it to a largely contract-based business like Carillion, one of the problems, one of the fundamental problems of restructuring a Carillion-type business through administration is that the fact of insolvency terminates its contracts. If a company is entirely built on contract rights and those rights terminate, it's incredibly difficult then to restructure a company within administration. And there is another approach. The other approach is to say that contracts cannot terminate on insolvency. That happens to be the US approach, as it happens in other jurisdictions. And I think that, you know, if as a policy matter the UK were to decide that it would want to promote the restructuring of corporate enterprises, addressing this ipso facto issue in contract termination, and that was probably the fundamental issue on Carillion. And if we could just give an example. So Carillion was taking place roughly the same time as the restructuring of a large and complex nuclear construction technology business called Westinghouse. And like Carillion, Westinghouse was built on a number of very significant long-term contracts. It turned out, and this is all public, that some of those contracts were deeply unprofitable. The US approach to restructuring is to enable an enterprise in Chapter 11 to protect the good contracts and reject or amend bad contracts. And that approach enables the company to sort of ring-fence what is good about its business and isolate itself from what is bad about the business. Now, in the UK, we have, you know, both within the world of financial institution restructuring, more generally, that idea that you have a good company and a bad company, you try and establish them. But if you're trying to establish in a restructuring a good company within an administration, and the administration has terminated all of your contracts, whether they're good or bad, it makes the process of trying to separate out the kind of good part of the enterprise from the bad part of the enterprise incredibly hard. And my strong view is that contract-based businesses really cannot be restructured within administration without addressing the ipso facto clause issue and stopping termination of contracts by reason of insolvency. And that would enable an enterprise then to kind of properly separate out good contracts and bad contracts, keep the good, reject the bad, and proceed to restructure the enterprise.
So it seems that cherry-picking some of the best aspects of the US Chapter 11 system would be a good thing for the UK's regime. And we have recently sort of had various people making calls for sort of that approach to be taken, including most recently a letter from Vince Cable MP, who was calling for a more orderly form of collapse, and he was calling for introducing some of the aspects of Chapter 11 into the UK system.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I mean, you know, Vince Cable has followed, you know, he's one of the senior politicians, and while he was a minister, someone who did follow restructuring and insolvency law with, you know, particular reference to the financial institutions, but I mean, many of the same issues apply, and I think he's spot on. So, you know, and of course, you know, we shouldn't label these things as just US. I mean, restructuring regimes and laws have these kinds of provisions. So, I would say, looking at the list, stay is important and could usefully be adopted. Bridge or dip financing is a very controversial issue and may just be too hard for the UK to accept.
Yes.
At this stage, and probably isn't essential. Contract termination, I think, is fundamental as a way of enabling, you know, a good business to be established within the restructuring regime.
But in the UK, you do have the CVA, which to some extent provides an ability. I think we've seen this particularly with retail companies, where there's an ability to kind of reconsider, renegotiate onerous leases and contracts. Yeah. So how does, I mean...
Yeah, so what we have in the UK, we have CVAs and we have schemes of arrangement. And so the CVA obviously rose from the insolvency legislation. Schemes been around for a long time. Both CVAs and schemes have become fundamental. And the English approach has been to say, really to say this, you can amend a class of contract. You can put that class, if it's leases, into a CVA. If it's bank debt or bonds, it could go into a scheme. And you could have the majority bind the minority to contract amendment. Mm-hmm. But that's as far as it goes. And what it doesn't have is the ability for a company to reject certain contracts. The landlord CVA depends upon the majority of landlords reaching a compromise with the company, binding the minority. It does not enable the company to separate out so-called good leases from bad leases and say, well, look, with amendments, we'll adopt the good leases, but the bad leases, we are just going
so
to reject.
So that model wouldn't have worked.
No, well, it might or might not. I mean, it'd be incredibly difficult, to take the CVA approach and sort of layer that onto a Carillion. So for Carillion to go to all of its contract counterparties and say, we will propose a scheme or a CVA so that we could amend contracts with the consent of the majority, binding the minority in that particular class or group of contracts, would be a very hard thing to do. I would say that it is not a huge step. If we accept that you can override minority contract rights through a CVA or a scheme, I don't think it's a big step from there to say, well, if we can use a scheme or a CVA to amend certain classes of contract, why do we not go one step further and enable a company in restructuring to look across all its contracts, reject some, adopt others, and amend others without having to do it through the scheme or the CVA? So I think if the drafts people of the 1985 insolvency legislation could look at 30 years later what has not happened through administration and what is now possible through schemes and CVAs, I suspect they would just rethink the whole approach to cram down and contract rejection.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to touch on a slightly different topic as well here. So Prime Minister Theresa May recently, with all this Carillion news, came out saying that there would be tough new rules introduced to tackle behavior of executives and actions that would put a pension scheme at risk. And then further, the government seems to be considering some type of plans to potentially leave individual executives personally liable if they put in jeopardy their companies and pension schemes or if the pension schemes collapse. So this kind of has some similar tenants or strings to the director's liability rules that we see in Germany and their insolvency processes. So I'm just wondering if this is even feasible or desirable to implement this kind of system in the UK system, because I think there's been a lot of outrage at some of the decisions the directors and executives made throughout the Carillion's operations and also just the restructuring process. Yep.
I think that's a very important point, and behind that there is a very significant sort of policy issue. And as we saw with the financial crisis, and as we've seen with large corporate collapses like Carillion, there is a great deal of public anger at what has happened, and criticism flies in all directions. Some people criticise PFI, some people criticise the directors, and it is understandable that politicians then call for a review of the accountability of executives. And if you look across restructuring regimes in developed jurisdictions, you see sort of two approaches. One is going back to sort of my theory that bankruptcy is the sort of handmaiden of capitalism, that you see that it is accepted that entrepreneurs or businesses or risk capital providers take risks, and from time to time those risks will not pay off and an enterprise will fail. But that it is considered to be better for the economy than to rescue what is good from the failed business and to enable what is bad to be dealt with, wrapped up, assets collected and administered as quickly and efficiently as possible. That if directors have wide fields of potential liability, that in the event that risk-taking, appropriate risk-taking, fails, and there is then personal liability, that can do two things. I mean, one, it can interfere with the process of establishing businesses because people feel it is too difficult to undertake risk if there is potentially punitive personal liability. And secondly, it makes the process of restructuring much, much more difficult. And I think that most people have had extensive experience of restructuring regimes with severe potential criminal penalties for actions by directors in the restructuring period find that is actually a significant hindrance to restructuring. Now, I'm not a fan extensive sanctions for directors, other than in circumstances of clear wrongdoing. I mean, nobody sanctions deliberate wrongdoing. Nobody sanctions misfeasance. Nobody sanctions companies not paying the tax they're supposed to pay or making the disclosures they're supposed to make. So those things should be sanctioned. But to expand the areas of potential liability for directors in the zone of insolvency, I do not think is likely to promote the successful restructuring of enterprises. However, I think it's clear that there is public demand that something be done. And I think it's worth just pausing and looking at what the reaction of the regulators and legislators to the financial crisis. So one of the features of the global financial crisis is that there were few instances of senior management of banks being at the wrong end of criminal proceedings. That was extremely, extremely rare. But there was a great attention on reward for failure. And as a result, reward schemes, compensation schemes, and bonus schemes for senior management of enterprises that subsequently fail or require restructuring were made the centre of regulatory action following the financial crisis to try and make it less likely that institutions fail and that management are properly focused on what kind of risks the institution is taking to reduce the moral hazard risk that enterprises speculate with the taxpayers' money. And that's what happened in the financial crisis. And I think there is a strong case to do exactly the same thing in the corporate field. It is hard to open on a weekly basis the Financial Times without details of some senior executives' compensation scheme, but very little attention is given by the investors, the shareholders, to what happens in the event of failure, the ability to claw back if an institution fails, potentially in the medium term, after the awards of bonus. And that did surface on Carillion because I think people were unhappy that the terms of the senior management compensation was adjusted to remove or reduce the risk of clawback. And I think there is merit, instead of imposing sort of potential additional criminal liabilities on directors of failed corporates, to instead look very closely at the terms of sort of institutional investor approved bonus schemes, to introduce clawback provisions that look a bit like the clawback provisions that are now standard and required for senior management compensation in banks. And I think that is the way to deal with management and try and make sure that the incentives of the shareholders and the management are aligned to encourage risk taking, to encourage proper risk taking, and enterprises to accept. We accept that enterprises from time to time will fail, but if they do fail, then the consequences of failure are borne by both the present and previous management through clawback of bonus schemes.
And in recent years, the UK's restructuring system, in particular schemes of arrangement, have been used by companies from all over the globe to restructure, particularly in light of Brexit and also the forthcoming EU restructuring directive. How much of a blow to the UK's restructuring reputation do you think that Carillion's failure is? And in particular, I'll be interested to hear your view on whether you think that non-UK debtors will actually be deterred from coming to the UK to restructure their debts.
Yeah, so there's a couple of points in that. First of all, let's tackle the kind of, you know, the Brexit issue. When I speak at conferences, the question I often get asked by anxious younger restructuring professionals, you know, what will happen after Brexit? Will the UK remain a centre for European restructuring? Now I think there are two points. One, I think the UK professionals are kidding themselves if we think that post Brexit, and if Brexit does involve the UK coming out of the single market and coming out of the customs union, I think it is unrealistic to expect German or French or Italian enterprises to look to the UK courts as a place to restructure. I think that we have to be realistic that as the EU harmonisation of the capital markets project continues apace with a big push from the Commission for the harmonisation across the EU countries of their restructuring law, I think what will come out of that is a clear preference for EU corporates to do their restructuring in the EU.
Yes.
And although it is possible that the UK courts, the UK process may find it has some ancillary role in that process, it will be ancillary. The complicating factor, of course, is that one of the kind of great gifts to the capitalist world from at least the English lawyers have been that a great deal of bank debt and bonds are governed by English law. And they'll probably remain, an English law piece, but I think it will become subsidiary to, an EU enterprise being restructured in the EU and not in London. So I think we will see post Brexit, the UK becoming a less significant venue for restructuring. But then, sort of to turn to Carillion, I don't think Carillion has a direct impact on the attractiveness as the UK currently as a venue for restructuring debt of European enterprises, at least pending our exit from the EU. But I think there are significant indirect consequences, and I think the indirect consequences go like this. I think what Carillion does show is that for contract-based businesses, an insolvency is a cliff edge. So financiers, less so for equity investors, but debt providers to enterprises like Carillion will model what happens on insolvency. And part of that analysis will be the recovery that might be expected in the event of failure. Now, where there is some certainty of some reasonable recovery through a restructuring, then debt, there is less risk for the financier, because even on business failure, they will get something out, particularly if they are the most senior debt in the capital structure. But if an enterprise is the kind of enterprise, perhaps because it's contract-based, that simply cannot be restructured through administration and collapses into liquidation with consequent tremendous loss of value, as we have seen in Carillion, then financiers will say, well, look, if I'm lending to this business and it fails, I may have zero recovery. And that, logically, should push up the price of debt. So I think the sort of the indirect consequence of Carillion is the failure to be able to extract the good value from businesses like that and separate out, good co from bad co, partly because of the ipso facto termination rules, will make lenders much more nervous about extending finance to businesses like that. And that indirect consequence, of course, will just simply push up the price of the provisions of those kind of services to the UK. Taxpayer.
Yeah, so on that point, because we are seeing some of the other construction businesses or some of the peers in the sector kind of have this ripple effect, not only because of the general economy and Brexit nervosity, but just experiencing some of the same business issues Carillion had. So I guess to extend kind of your most recent comments, just what are the implications going forward then if some of this contract problems are not addressed, you know, for the other companies that might find themselves in a position that Carillion is in?
Yeah. Okay. So I think there are two consequences. One is the sort of direct consequence for stakeholders in sort of peer businesses to Carillion. And you know, if those businesses end up in some form of debt restructuring, for example, negotiations around covenant breach, having to look for waivers. I mean, if they take a step towards a debt restructuring, I think as generalisation, one would say that the stakeholders will be extremely nervous. Mm-hmm. What that means will depend upon each particular situation. It may mean that some people refuse to proceed without some government support. If people see this cliff edge, and if a company does end up in restructuring and that fails and the business goes bust and people lose everything, there's no doubt that that will make stakeholders extremely nervous and influence their behaviour. And that's unlikely to be helpful. And then at a kind of political level, I think there is a kind of great danger that people draw conclusions from the failure to rescue a business like Carillion to say that outsourcing government contracting to the private sector simply isn't fit for the private sector and just doesn't work. And I sort of think that would be a shame, because I think it's actually addressing it's reaching the wrong conclusion. And the conclusion could be some contracts would be perhaps unprofitable and incapable of being renegotiated to make them profitable, and those contracts should be rejected. But the problem is, we don't have a restructuring law that's fit for purpose. Not that all government contracting to the private sector doesn't work and more should be undertaken by the government. And where you come out on that issue rather depends on whether you think it's a good thing for governments to be providing services across the board. And just as I do not think it's necessarily desirable to have the government be the liquidator of a Carillion, because I don't think governments should be. I think the less businesses governments run, the better. I also think there is a place for outsourcing in the private sector, and if we had a decent restructuring law, I think that instances like Carillion could be managed and contained, and a sort of restructured core Carillion could have emerged. And that would avoid people reaching the wrong conclusions about sort of PFI contracting generally.
So kind of just to continue talking about the government's role a bit here, and as a way to kind of wrap this up, and I might be asking you to go on a limb a little bit here in terms of your opinion, but can we elaborate a bit on what should the role of the government be in terms of responsibility, support, and bailout? Because with Carillion, there was kind of two big criticisms in terms of how I understood it was, one, you had the surprise liquidation and the perception that there weren't all these other restructuring alternatives that were considered, and there was the role of the government in maybe not pushing for creditors or stakeholders to consider a certain option, or not allowing them more time to figure it out by not supporting something. And then there was the other side of the government's criticism was that they had actually, 6 months prior, knew that there were problems with Carillion, yet were still giving them contracts and supporting the business in a way that might not have been helpful.
Yeah.
So there's this two sides of the issue of where the government didn't support and was criticized, and did support and was criticized.
Yeah, and that's right. I think the government finds itself in an extremely hard place because following the financial crisis, it is seen to be politically unacceptable for the government to be providing public money, taxpayers' money, to institutions to benefit other stakeholders. One of the reasons that the law relating to the restructuring of financial institutions has been significantly amended is to reduce or eliminate the risk that public money is used because a private sector restructuring solution cannot be achieved. I think we have exactly the same problem with Carillion. I think the government the problem the government found itself facing was, if one accepts the sort of premise that Carillion could not be restructured within the private sector, because restructuring law did not enable a good Carillion to emerge from the bad Carillion, having rejected bad contracts that cannot be done, then the government either the entire enterprise collapses, or we actually have to put public money in to protect the interests of stakeholders. And of course, it's very difficult to protect the interests of some and not other stakeholders. And the idea that the government would sort of nationalise a Carillion or to pass a piece of legislation to wipe out the shareholders, I think was just too difficult. You know, looking back, I mean, what should happen is that a business like Carillion, even though it has significant government contracting, its restructuring should be a private sector matter. It should be between the shareholders, the financial credit providers, the employees, the unions, the pension funds. I mean, it ought to be a private sector solution. And that those government contracts that are simply unprofitable and cannot be progressed without renegotiation are either rejected or, after negotiation, amended and adopted by the restructuring by Carillion post restructuring. So if you have a fit for purpose private sector restructuring regime for enterprises, then the question of government bailout should go away, because no one would expect taxpayers' money to be put in to benefit, you know, shareholders in a private enterprise. I mean, they should take the losses that follow. I mean, as investors, people expect that from time to time their investment will fail and they will lose everything. And I'm a great proponent of governments largely, you know, not being involved in debt restructuring. There are exceptions. I mean, occasionally a restructuring simply cannot be completed without government involvement. And, you know, one of the most obvious examples I was involved in my career was British Energy restructuring. I mean, the cost of decommissioning the UK's, you know, nuclear power stations was so massive, the only place to have that risk dealt with was by the government. The government then having adopted that, the burden of the rest of the British Energy restructuring fell on the stakeholders. And I think a Carillion, it, you know, could have been an entirely private sector debt restructuring to enable, you know, a new Carillion, having almost certainly wiped out the existing shareholders, with potential clawback from directors in relation to their kind of bonuses. The rejection of bad contracts, the renegotiation of some contracts that could be made profitable, and a smaller new Carillion would emerge, and that's how restructuring should be done. But for the whole thing to collapse and then be left with an arm of government to kind of sort out seems the worst of all alternatives.
Yeah, I guess just one point to make here, though, is that the government still does have a stake in something like Carillion, though. You were mentioning the nuclear power plant example. Mm. I mean, some of the contracts, if you had a system where you could, you know, reject the bad contracts, yeah, keep the good contracts, what if some of the bad contracts you're rejecting are vital contracts, things that, you know, Carillion was running hospitals or prisons, yeah, or doing infrastructure projects for the government? I mean, these are services that most people would consider are kind of government has a responsibility to provide that service for its, yeah, for its population.
I think that needs attention. So if the government has contracted out, you know, essential services, the services must continue. And in the event that the service provider fails, you know, if the government's choice is, well, we could bail out the service provider, and that seems, you know, politically and you know, and economically entirely unacceptable. If the contracting party is attempting a restructuring, then it seems to me that the contract would be rejected. There would be a period of negotiation when you could work out whether the contract continued on different terms to enable it to be profitable and remain within the new restructured Carillion, or the government would step in. And whether the government, through outsourcing, has got the, you know, the step in the event that the provider fails and the contract is rejected, whether the government's got everything it needs to step in, or it needs to look at a sort of default regime of step-in rights to be able to seamlessly take over, mm-hmm, the administration of a contracted out contract. You know, probably needs addressing, but there are step-in rights in lots of different areas, and I don't think there's any particular reason why there shouldn't be some, you know, enhanced step-in rights for, you know, essential government contracts, things that the government just has to do. It's tried to get the private sector to carry them out. That's failed. In a particular instance, the government needs rights to sort of take them over. It can't renegotiate the contract. But having, you know, being able to have that renegotiation, see whether there is a basis for a restructured Carillion with good contracts to continue with that, say, contract for the administration of sort of, you know, prisons, or whether that needs to be taken back over the government, depend on the circumstances. But at least there'd be a chance of, you know, negotiating restructuring in the private sector and having that contract on amended terms continuing the private sector, or the government takes it back.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Well, thank you, Andrew, for your time. Thanks, Don. And thank you for listening to us. If you're interested in reading more about the UK insolvency reforms, head on over to DebtWire and take a look at some of Don's analysis pieces. Otherwise, keep up to date on Carillion and some of its peers and how they're dealing with it, everything that's going on in the sector through our stories. And of course, feel free to reach out to our expert, Andrew, for advice on UK insolvency reforms or any of the other issues we discussed today. All right, bye-bye.
Thank you.